is called understanding and appreciating the apparent contradictions and the difficult and controversial passages in Prabhupada's books. And this has two parts, today and tomorrow. There are sections in Prabhupada's books which I've called them three different things. Apparently contradictory, difficult, or controversial. We can call them all difficult passages. And they may harm a devotee who has weak faith. He has trouble dealing with these passages. Or aside from such a devotee, even a fixed devotee has trouble preaching these to the public. And the public sometimes finds these, and they find it very difficult to accept Krishna consciousness because of the difficult passages and difficult things. Therefore, it seems worthy to discuss about it, and so to speak, bring some of these problems out of the closet. Then we will understand that we don't have to doubt Srila Prabhupada or Krishna consciousness because of these difficult sections. In fact, it's the nature of Krishna consciousness to deal with these. As Prabhupada says in a purport, Bhagavad Gita 6.8, by transcendental knowledge one can remain steady in his convictions, but by mere academic knowledge one can be easily deluded and confused by apparent contradictions. It is the realized soul who is actually self-controlled. It has nothing to do with mundane scholarship. And then we should be able not only to solve it within the movement, but to preach about it to people in general. And in presenting it, not just look fanatical about it either. So contradictory statements are statements which, or we sometimes say self-contradictory, things seem to oppose each other. And in logic, of course, this is a disqualification. If in your line of argument you have something that is opposed by another statement in your propositions. However, aside from Prabhupada's commentaries, in the Vedas themselves, it's recognized that there are apparently contradictory statements. The famous one is, there are statements that you should not touch any stool of an animal. It's so impure that if you do touch it by mistake, then you have to immediately bathe. But another place, cow dung, which is the stool of an animal, is declared as pure. This has been discussed by Prabhupada, the nature of that kind of apparent contradictory statement in the Vedas. He makes the point that actually you have to accept it because of the maxim that the Vedas are perfect. And you can later find out how these statements can be adjusted by ordinary logic and why some are exceptional. But I don't intend to discuss that this kind of contradiction as much as in Prabhupada's purports, where he says something in one place in terms of explanation, not just Vedic axiom, but he's explaining things, and then he seems to give another explanation which seems to contradict the first. Now, if this were if it were true that he really is contradictory, so contradictory, it would mean that the philosophy is not fixed and strong and consistent. And or it might mean that whoever was making such a presentation was going to such lengths to balance things in different viewpoints that it become neutralized and indecisive. So we want to, we aim to show that this is not the case. All right, I'll proceed with the first so-called contradiction, and that is a discussion about grihastha life in the books. So, does grihastha life obstruct spiritual progress, or is it favorable for spiritual progress? Just to give an indication how this does appear to be presented differently, in the index to the fifth canto, I looked under grihastha, and one item is grihastha. Liberation can be enhanced by the topic in the index. And then right under it says, grihastha, life's mission defeated by. So, with a cursory look at that, you may think, what is this? Either it enhances liberation or it defeats life's mission. I can't do both. So, one of the attempts to solve this has been to say that we should always remember there are two different words for householder life. One is grihamedi, which is a materialistic, envious householder, and the grihastha is an ashram, spiritual ashram, for making progress in Krishna consciousness. That's, of course, an important and bona fide reply, but sometimes Prabhupada clearly uses the word grihastha and uses it to say that things, that it's not a favorable situation. For example, in the Bhagavatam purport 5.14.18, the so-called comfortable family position is compared to a dark well in a field. If one falls in a dark well covered by grass, his life is lost, despite his cry for rescue. Highly advanced spiritualists therefore recommend that one should not enter the grihastha ashram. It is better to prepare oneself in the brahmachari ashram for austerities and remain a pure brahmachari throughout one's life so that one will not feel the piercing thorns of material life in the grihastha ashram. One point I want to make before I go further with this is that this example is interesting, and I am actually trying to come to grips with the contradiction, but I'm mostly offering it as an example, and we'll have other examples. So what I really like to pay attention to is dilemmas and possible ways to solve the dilemmas and to understand them. We can't avoid getting into the issues, but as yesterday we discussed some issues and we couldn't together completely put them to rest, that no one will consider them controversial anymore. We may not be able to do that to everyone's satisfaction on something like grihastha also. But I hope we'll remove some of the bewilderment about the difficult passages and by everyone's contribution, develop more process to deal with them. So that was a very strong statement about the grihastha ashram that we just read. And what somebody might say right here, well, I don't care what else you find, even if you find another statement that says something favorable for grihastha, it's not going to really completely moderate this statement, because this statement is what it is. That grihastha is not favorable. Another answer to that occurs in that the use of the word grihastha is sometimes done flexibly to sometimes mean a materialistic version of householder life and sometimes the spiritual one. This flexibility of definition we see Prabhupada do in other words like karma yoga. Sometimes in Bhagavad Gita, karma yoga means the materialistic approach to spiritual life where you keep something for yourself but you try to dovetail it with Krishna consciousness. And other times, karma yoga is simply a synonym for bhakti or action in Krishna consciousness, the best kind of yoga, karma yoga. There is a flexibility in the usage there. Another word is an English term, a pure devotee. Pure devotee, just take it like that, it can be, according to how it's used, it can sometimes mean a beginning pure devotee, and sometimes it means the devotee without the slightest taint of any anartha. We would sometimes say, common talk among devotees, well, is this person a pure devotee? And we're thinking of the most exalted stage, like Prabhupada is a pure devotee. Sometimes pure devotee means any faithful ISKCON, a devotee who doesn't have any sympathy for jnana and karma in his presentation. I don't have evidence of that, but there are such sections. I think you'll agree. So I'm just suggesting that grihastha is sometimes used like that. And with this also brings up the concept of context, which I'll talk about a little bit later, but this is very important. Context means the specific situation in which the discussion is brought up. And it shouldn't unnecessarily be broadened to refer to all cases. Now, naturally, we want to hear Prabhupada praising the grihastha to show the very thing we're talking about today, that sometimes he says one, sometimes he says the other. Prabhupada writes in Bhagavatam 5.5.8, sometimes it is found among exalted personalities like Lord Brahma that the wife and children are not a cause of bondage. On the contrary, the wife actually helps further spiritual life and liberation. So as I've suggested a few ways to approach it, another way, as a solution, is to try to find passages where Prabhupada himself acknowledges that this is an issue that sometimes is discussed in different ways, and he deals with it himself, rather than me talking about it. If Prabhupada himself, in different passages where there's something that appears to be contradictory, deals with it, I would think of these as key passages where he notes different extremes and then offers us a conclusion. They would seem to be particularly important when these issues are being discussed. Here's one on grihastha life. I remember reading this for the first time when I happened to be a grihastha at that time. And it really struck out at me that, well, this is something that seems to balance and be conclusive. It comes in the third canto, the 31st chapter, 42nd purport, teachings of Lord Kapila, after a string of devastating verses against association with women. And then the purport says, in these instructions of Lord Kapila Dev, it is explained that not only is woman the gateway to hell for a man, but man is also the gateway to hell for a woman. It is a question of attachment. A man becomes attached to a woman because of her service, her beauty, and many other assets. And similarly, a woman becomes attached to a man for his giving her a nice place to live, ornaments, dress, and children. It is a question of attachment for one another. As long as either is attached to the other for such material enjoyment, the woman is dangerous for the man, and the man is also dangerous for the woman. But if the attachment is transferred to Krishna, both of them become Krishna conscious, and then marriage is very nice. Therefore, Rupa Goswami recommends, Yuktam Vairagyam Uchite. Man and woman should live together as householders in relationship with Krishna, only for the purpose of discharging duties in the service of Krishna. Engage the children, engage the wife, and engage the husband, all in Krishna conscious duties, and then all of these bodily and material attachments will disappear. Since the Vaya medium is Krishna, the consciousness is pure, there is no possibility of degradation at any time. And there are some other cases where both are acknowledged. I have other evidences, but I don't want to spend too much time on it. If later you want to hear these, they're the same thing, examples of Prabhupada frankly saying that there's some defect in the Grihastha ashram, some danger, but then conclusively also saying that it's a good thing if it's done in a certain way, and that the Lord himself has endorsed it in his own activities and teaching. So we can look for key passages. It's also helpful, as in anything with Prabhupada's teachings, to find not only what he writes in his books, but from his life, how he dealt with the issues in practical ways. So there was a time particularly when he dealt with some controversy about Grihasthas in 1976, Mayapur gathering. And there was a heated, the whole society was actually up in agitation about whether association with Grihasthas was bad for devotees who wanted to advance, or whether Grihasthas could even preach at all. So anyway, it was going on. And I have a little excerpt from that on the morning walk. Madhavisa says, in the 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, in one of your purports, you say that a sannyasi should never discourage a young man from getting married. But on the other hand, we understand that a sannyasi should encourage a young man to remain brahmachari. So it seems to me like there is some kind of contradiction. Prabhupada. According to time and circumstance, just like Krishna says, always be engaged in your prescribed work. And at last he says, sarva dharma. So now you adjust. That is not a contradiction. It is just suitable to the time and circumstance. Madhavisa, but is there some conclusion? Prabhupada, the real aim is that you have to become the eternal servant of Krishna. Prabhupada went on to settle the Grihastha controversy by stating that one has to judge for spiritual advancement, not by which ashram one was in. This passage is particularly good, not only so much for the Grihastha example, but for how to deal with it. Prabhupada, using slightly different words, refers to that context thing that I mentioned. Krishna may say one thing one time and one thing another time. At least the point is he's not guilty of some fumbling contradiction that you should be bewildered, that one thing is here, one thing is there. You better study it more. Study why he says earlier in the Bhagavad Gita, always do your dharma, and then later he says give up your dharma. You have to study it. I remember very early hearing that, that you can't see Krishna. Nobody can see Krishna. In the Bhagavad Gita, there are different verses of being no one knows. And then Prabhupada was saying, you can see Krishna. And so I asked, I don't understand. He said that you can't see Krishna, but then he said you can see Krishna. So then he showed me different verses that you, and with an understanding. You can't see Krishna if you have any material taint. A pure devotee can see Krishna. But until out, I was bewildered. Well, what is this philosophy? You can't see. Is this just some double talk? They don't really know whether you can see Krishna or not. It's such an unknown thing. I better go on to some other philosophy where I can get some straight answers. This is dogmatic. So this can be very problematic if you think you're hearing a contradictory philosophy, or you think the person who's speaking to you, he really doesn't know. And when you ask him something, he says one thing, then he says another thing because he really doesn't know. But he just contradicts himself. And especially nowadays, people try not to get caught, even if you find the defect. The Prabhupada says, there's no contradiction, but Krishna, according to time and circumstance, Krishna says what he says. I want to move on to difficult to understand passages, which is somewhat different. Sometimes Prabhupada's statements are clearly consistent in themselves, but they are appear to be in direct conflict with science, for example. So the difficulty is not that Prabhupada so much to different things. He keeps saying the same thing, but it's really controversial in terms of the, well, science and other material knowledge disciplines also. But one of the classic ones with science is, what did Prabhupada say about going to the moon, man going to the moon? This is like almost a notorious part of the Hare Krishna movement, which any devotee might be a bit reluctant to expose when someone first wants to know about our movement. So what did Prabhupada say? Here's one straightforward comment from the interview with the LA Times, where a reporter was really grilling him just on this one point for hours. He said, Prabhupada says, if you can go, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the authoritative Vedic scripture that we follow, there is a statement that for promoting one to the moon planet, one has to accustom oneself to different kinds of worshipping process. Those who are engaged in pious activities according to Vedic rituals can go to the moon planet. There are two kinds of activities, vicious and pious. Those who are engaged in the vicious activities cannot go to the moon. Everything on the moon is advanced, so you cannot expect to go and land there. You require a different type of body to live there. You cannot go and live there abruptly. Space uniform is not adequate. So that's pretty straightforward, and we've heard that before. According to the Vedic knowledge, the moon is a heavenly planet, so the impious men could not go there by the Ravana method of technology. Now, someone may say, well, Prabhupada says some different things about that too. I think it's very clear that he says man didn't go to the moon. What he sometimes does is concede a point for the sake of argument. Sometimes if you're arguing with a person and he won't budge in the slightest, but you feel your argument is so strong, you'll even concede that, well, maybe part A of what you say, I don't agree that it's true, but I'll just, for the sake of argument, I'll concede that even if what you say were true, still, and then you still can defeat him or point out how it's defective. So Prabhupada sometimes seemed to engage in that with this moon issue, and he said in that same talk where the man was insisting, well, he said, Swami, you may say that, but they've definitely gone to the moon. We've got the pictures, we've got everything. So what are you going to say now? Prabhupada says, if you can go and land in the moon and come back, that may be a pleasant thing for you. But we don't think it's a very nice thing. If I go in the New York border and see and come back and I'm not allowed to enter, why should I take so much trouble? It is useless trouble. But even after saying that, Prabhupada then reverted to the full argument that they couldn't have gone there in any sense. He said, if actually anyone goes there, he will not like to come back. Why leave there? Because the place is more comfortable than this place. The duration of life on the moon is more, the standard of living is fine, everything is more advanced. He said if they did go to the moon, they wouldn't have just looked at it and come back, because the moon is a great place, not the place where you went, or said you went. In purports, Prabhupada clearly says man could not go to the moon. I'll just read off some references. 519, he says it was unsuccessful. Bhagavatam 516.8, he says, perhaps they landed on Rahu, an invisible planet. Bhagavatam 5.22.8, he says the moon is in some sense higher than the sun, and then he gives the reasoning that since we can't reach the sun by our spacecraft, how can we think that we could reach the moon? So it's consistent, that the conflict between the Prabhupada and the Vedas is consistent conflict. And we can be sure of what Prabhupada is saying. But what about all this scientific evidence and so much conviction that the public has that they definitely did go? This is a great obstacle here. So in the face of this, we should have faith that the Vedic version is superior because it's free of the four defects that all human beings have. And by accepting knowledge in this way, you save time, and it's not the imperfect method. You really have to choose one or the other. Prabhupada says, the Srimad Bhagavatam gives much information which may not tally with our present experience, but as far as Indian sages are concerned, Knowledge is received from the Vedic literatures, and the authorities accept without any hesitation that we should look through the pages of authentic books of knowledge. And you can't really accept both. This has been attempted a lot by theology in the modern age. They concede everything. They concede Darwin's theory, they can certainly concede man going to the moon, and they keep retreating and saying, but still, our scripture is true. They try to do both, accept the scientists and accept their scripture. Prabhupada points out, you really can't do that in 2226 purport. We should not depend on the fragmentary authority of the materialistic science for knowing things beyond the range of scientific purview. For a common man, both modern science and Vedic wisdom are simply to be accepted because none of the statements, either of modern science or the Vedic literature, can be verified by him. In other words, both are accepted ultimately on authority, not on experience. The alternative for common man is to believe either of them or both of them. The Vedic way of understanding is more authentic because it has been accepted by the acharyas, who are not only faithful and learned, but also are liberated souls without any of the flaws of conditioned souls. The modern scientists, however, are conditioned souls liable to so many errors and mistakes. Therefore, the safe side is to accept the authentic version of the Vedic literatures like Srimad Bhagavatam, which is accepted unanimously by the great acharyas. Prabhupada also said, in the face of this conflict, that we devotees, we should be careful not to be affected by our inborn Western prejudices. He called it a prejudice, in other words. That without reasoning, you've adopted this idea, but it's science, it must be right, rather than accept the Vedic conclusion. He said a lot of that is just you're conditioned with preconceptions of how everything is. They have cheated about going to the moon, so how can we believe them? Don't be puffed up by your so-called education, it has no value. We've gotten involved in the issue, but the principle is difficult passages, hard for us Westerners to accept, like that one, and there are others. We'll deal with some of them tomorrow also. And so as we saw, we selected how Prabhupada personally dealt with issues like this with his own devotees, as with the Grihastha. We saw there was a devotee who was his secretary in early years, Purushottam, who really got upset about Prabhupada saying man didn't go to the moon, or even in London, and it was being shown on the television, and Prabhupada said it wasn't really happening. He became so upset, he left Prabhupada's service, and he left the Krishna conscious movement. So you can study that. I won't go into it now, but that's on this particular point, Prabhupada dealing with a doubtful disciple. But when it was all over, Prabhupada was surprised that he left and said that he may have disbelieved me, but I don't see why he disbelieved the Vedic statements. Now, in one sense, I have no place in talking about this because it's a scientific matter. We have special qualified devotees, such as Sadhguru Prabhu and others. In fact, I phoned him about this, and I said, I'm presenting this in Prabhupada appreciation. Can you give me a brief description so I can give to the devotees with scientific background as to why we can understand man didn't go to the moon? So he thought about it. And he said, it's not possible to present this in a brief form. He said, I can't do it. I said, if you do it, he said, you'll just raise more doubts. So, from their viewpoint, they're certainly working on it, but it's such a step-by-step presentation that they want to make to tackle this that he wouldn't give me a popular or condensed version. I recently read Prabhupada saying to a doubtful professor, that Professor Wolf, who was in L.A. for a while, who wrote to Prabhupada, you're all against science, and this is crazy. And so he asked Prabhupada to defend himself in detailed ways, and Prabhupada said, I've asked them to do it, Sarup Damodar, Sadaput, and Madhava. He said, you can talk with them. He said, they will figure it out. So he wasn't even going to get into the details. But it was significant that he did point to those devotees. They are expected to give very conclusive evidence. And I think Sadaput has prepared a book, and it's going to be published soon, on the whole cosmology, the whole so-called fifth canto is difficult to understand. He said it's not difficult to understand, and here it is. So we will get this information from them. I wasn't attempting to take their place, but I was doing what is in the realm of every ordinary devotee, to show how the Shastras should be our guides, why they're better than material knowledge. When it comes down to it, this will be mostly our defense, and perhaps we'll just give them Sadaput's book for higher argumentation. So it shouldn't be something that we're afraid of. And there's a wonderful letter on this I'd like to read, which Prabhupada wrote to Madhava when he was asking, is it all right if we do a lot of research on this matter? Prabhupada says, regarding details of the universe, be satisfied by reading only the Bhagavatam. What is the use of reading other books? You are not going there. Simply keep faith that whatever we describe, that is a fact. After all, we are insignificant creature in the universe. So whether you take to modern scientists or Sukadeva Goswami, it is inconceivable. It is best to keep the faith in Sukadeva Goswami, because actually, our only business is to go back home, back to Godhead. So whether Sukadeva or the modern scientists are right or wrong, it's nothing interesting to us. We want to go back home, back to Godhead. To bring up that other issue. Yanti mam, yajinoki mam. So that's a wonderful letter. Prabhupada saying, and it's not even important, and at the time of our death, as devotees aspiring to go back to Godhead, we're not really want to know. So now I'm going to leave my body. Now I really have to know, did they go to the moon or not? And if we find out, it's not going to matter that much. But whether we're free of desires and whether we love Krishna, that's the important thing. And that you'll get from Sukadeva Goswami. That's the important thing. So now we'll get into the group discussion of these things, which I hope you'll take part in answering. Here's the first, yes?
At one point I was thinking that over the years that we spent in Krishna consciousness, at least trying to be Krishna conscious, we've seen that the statements of the Vedic literatures or Srila Prabhupada, which seemed outlandish or even unbelievable in the face of our Western conditioning or inborn Western prejudice, said, we've actually seen these statements have become verified and by the scientific community itself. And once I made a list of so many things that 15 years ago when I came to Krishna consciousness, they were saying that life can't exist in fire and so many things. So then we had this article in BTG, remember that one about some scientists found that there were living entities, some kind of microbial entities in a superheated steam.
Yeah.
And this completely threw out the whole idea of autoclave and sterile, because I went to medical school, so we had all the sterilization techniques that at a certain temperature you could sterilize surgical equipment and there would be no more germs you could operate on a person. So these scientists in that BTG article, they found that actually living entities are existing at 500 degrees Fahrenheit or whatever, which is beyond the sterilization temperature. And Gita says there's living entities everywhere. In fire, on the sun planet. So the scientists, by their own inventions, their own discoveries, are finding, yes, there is life in superheated steam. So they have to accept that. Or, there's the whole list of them, but one thing is, in medicine, they have two kinds of nervous system, voluntary and involuntary. So it was thought, up until the time of, 1965, it was thought that there's a whole group of bodily functions, Dr. Kim, that are controlled, that we can't have conscious control of. But then there's this one foundation in Kansas, Meninger Foundation, that brought all these yogis over there. And the yogis would just stop their heart at will. They would speed up, fibrillation. They would make their heart go faster. They would stop it. They would be buried underground for a week. They would take one breath and be buried underground. And they started, quantifying and measuring scientifically all these, what they thought were phenomena. And all the so-called theories and scientific understanding of physiology and the human anatomy was completely debunked by these mystic yogis who could do the impossible. And these are the kind of things you read in the Bhagavatam, as somebody You know, Sukracharya took the demons and he dropped them in some, you know, swimming pool and they came up alive again. You know, the Sanjeevani art and all these things. They, you know, you read about, oh, that's impossible, you know, this and that. No, we, because of our inborn prejudice.
Yeah.
But actually, one by one, and just like sometimes they say the Vedas were written 3,000 years ago by Bodhidev or whatever, Bodhidev, you know, like that.
Yeah.
And we say 5,000 years. So the scientists, they've just been digging on Dwarka, the archaeologists, the, you know, the scientific community of archaeologists. They're doing dating techniques with some of the stone and columns they found, and they find those columns are 5,000 years old. Which means it's Dwarka. At least they're surmising that these are the remnants of the Dwarka, Krishna's colony in Dwarka. So if Dwarka was there, that means, you know, that's 5,000 years, it means the Vedas were there, you know. Because they say the Vedas were 3,000 years ago. Part of the Vedas is description of Dwarka Lila. So this, even their own findings, they're starting, in other words, the point I'm making is we have outlandish points about, you know, transmigration of the soul and about all these different things. But actually, one by one, the scientific community is maturing in their knowledge and understanding to confirm these points rather than deny them.
Yeah.
So a loyal and faithful devotee will see year by year, these scientists will actually help you increase and build your faith in the Vedas and in Krishna because they're just confirming what we already knew 15 years ago.
I think there's some passage Prabhupada says, perhaps one day they will be able to understand that you can go back to God, something like that. Indicating that by material science, maybe, of course, it could only happen with Krishna consciousness, but maybe maybe they'll find the Vedic conclusions. And it's happening. Or a couple. One is in the purport to Chaitanya Charitamrita, chapter 1, text 50. He says, in time, material scientists may also know how we can communicate with the Vaikuntha world. He's saying that Lord Brahma, he did it. I'll go back up. Modern science can communicate using material discoveries such as radio, television, and computers. But the science invoked by the austerities of Lord Brahma, the original father of mankind, was still more subtle. In time, material scientists may also know how we can communicate with the Vaikuntha world. I don't know exactly how to take that. So it's almost like there's a touch of tongue-in-cheek because we know that even if you go millions of miles, millions of lifetimes with the speed of the mind by material spacecraft, you can't reach Vaikuntha. Of course, if the scientists become devotees, then they'll understand. But another way to take it is sort of the way it was indicated yesterday that, well, it's the truth and it's there, so if they keep working, maybe they'll find it. Super soul will guide them to discover this thing, which is reality, and that is Vaikuntha. At least, aside from my interpretation, there it is. And there's another one from Easy Journey. Materialistic science may one day finally discover the eternal anti-material world which has for so long been unknown to the wranglers of gross materialism. So by Krishna's grace, apparently by their material methods, they are discovering these things that are already there in the Vedas. So this is a continuation of the subject of yesterday, more appreciation of controversial things in Prabhupada's books. Either they may not be controversial in ISKCON, but they're certainly controversial in our interface with material world, science, and Western knowledge, or they may even be, in a sense, controversial among ISKCON, with the, the other point I made, the problem that occurs to a devotee's mind sometimes in his faithfulness, whether there's actually a straight conclusion in the philosophy or something contradictory or unclear about this. So today I'm focusing on a little different point. How to faithfully and intelligently represent Prabhupada on these matters. And in the course of discussing this, we'll go over two of such issues. One is the role of women, and another is some features of Vedic government. And if we don't lay all the issues to rest for all time, at least we'll have some more exercise in how to try to understand these things and deal with them. I'd like to review some of the techniques we went over yesterday for handling things like this in Prabhupada's books that appear to be contradictory or controversial. First thing is to know what Prabhupada actually said by a study of his books. Then we said that it's important where these things occur, what the discussion is, be context sensitive. Could someone define what context sensitive means?
Mushing?
Being aware of how it was mentioned in context.
Yeah, exactly the application that Prabhupada was making at that time. For example, Prabhupada may say to somebody, don't eat sweets. Now, that doesn't mean all people shouldn't eat sweets. Or he even said once to one devotee, you should eat more. And to another devotee, he said, you should eat less. So the context is important. Context is important. Well, he was saying that to, in this circumstance, to these people. Then I gave the phrase, key passages. I said we should find key passages in Prabhupada's books regarding these issues. What did I mean by key passages? Bhakti Siddhanta?
Certain, whether it's symbolic, certain
phrases. Yeah, where he particularly brought it out that there's this side and there's that side, and then gave some synthesis or seemed to deal with it in a way like that. I read a passage about householder life where he said it's very dangerous, the road to hell for both parties. But if they pursue it without attachment and put the attachment on Krishna, then it's very, very nice. So passages like that. Then I said we should overcome doubts by accepting that the Vedic knowledge is superior to the empirical process. Also, we should be aware of and try to overcome our Western prejudices, facing them as just that, not just Western training, but Western prejudice. See how Prabhupada personally dealt with the issues? That will be valuable too. And then, preach boldly as he did. Now, going on, I want to discuss two wrong responses to controversial items. And they're like two extreme attitudes and both wrong. One of them I call waffling. Does everybody know what a waffle is? It's a battered cake that is served at breakfast with syrup. Actually, I looked up in the dictionary I was carrying, that's all it said. But there are slang dictionaries also. And waffle is a slang term. Any good American slang experts? You know what waffle is? Yeah.
Taking no real position, moving to say that way back and forth.
Yeah, not being straightforward. Right, taking this side and that side. Politicians are very famous and expert for this, even U.S. presidents. There's an example in the Chaitanya Charitamrita in the Sakshi Gopal story. Remember that the old Brahmin, he promised to give that young Brahmin his daughter. And then when he got home, it was a big controversy. So his son gave him some advice on how to deal with it. And then actually when he was faced with the town people, they said, well, did you give your daughter or not? And he said, did you promise? He said that you promised. He said, I don't actually remember whether I said that. So he didn't say that he didn't say it, and he didn't say that he did say it. He was a liberated soul, but in the difficulty of that situation, he waffled. So that's what waffle means. Somebody does it because of lack of conviction. So in regard to this issue we discussed about the moon, that a man didn't go to the moon, and it's quite clear that Prabhupada said he didn't, and he's put it in his purports. by lack of conviction, sometimes devotees will waffle on this statement and other statements. But one way they may do this, these are all examples of what we shouldn't do, using only Prabhupada's statements in which he said that maybe man did visit the moon, but even if they did visit, it's a useless waste of time, better spend the money on the earth, on poverty programs and things like that. So we said yesterday that when Prabhupada says something like that, it was conceding the argument, or conceding the opposition for the sake of argument. That's why he mostly did that. But if you were to take that as Prabhupada's only or main conclusive view on the moon, well, that's not what Prabhupada said. He said they didn't go. But out of like fear or lack of conviction, if that's what you always say, well, it's a good opener perhaps. But if they really press you and say, well, did they go or not? And you say, well, they may have gone. We admit that they may have gone, but what's the good of it? So you're not saying what he actually said. There's another example. This is a little more stretching it than waffling. I guess this is like a... In fact, when this was done, one of the senior devotees referred to this as a maha waffle. One devotee, he actually wrote letters to all the GBC with this viewpoint that by studying the issue, he decided that it couldn't be possible, as Prabhupada says, that the moon is further away than the sun. It's just so obvious that it's not, that it's closer than the sun. So whenever Prabhupada says that, he didn't really mean it. And one way you can notice this is that he always seems to say it in a joking way, and so it couldn't be taken seriously. And what he really meant was that the sun is closer to our lives. The way we draw from its heat is more important. It's closer, in that sense, than the moon. Well, this is a maha waffle.